chair, he's in a position to actually do something about it. The first step is to abandon the outdated and inappropriate fast-track process, which allows trade negotiators to hide from the public what's being negotiated in our names. It also allows it to be signed before the public sees the text, and amendments are forbidden, and that, at that point, changes are all but impossible. So we're here today to deliver thousands and thousands of signatures on these floppy disks, and we are just one of six different petition deliveries happening all across the state in every one of Senator Wyden's district offices. So altogether, we have 13,721 signatures from people who signed floppy disks to encourage Senator Wyden to hold true to his democratic principles and stand up for ordinary Americans.
That was Elizabeth Swaggart, director of the Oregon Fair Trade Campaign. Later, tech worker Mitch Besser spoke about the TPP's implications for employment and job security in the tech industry.
So I was asked to come today to talk about job loss, and I'll tell you the story of what happened to me. In 2010, I was working in Corvallis for a company called IGT that makes slot machines globally. And when I started that job a few months in, they announced they were going to be opening an office in Beijing, China. And we were expected to train people for that job. Of course, they told us we weren't going to be losing our jobs. They couldn't find people to do the work. But when I tried to hand them resumes of friends who were looking for work, they didn't want anything to do with that. So that was clearly a lie. So over the course of about a year and a half, we had people come from China. We trained them. We had people go to China to train them there, and they came here. And eventually, they did end up closing our office, no surprise. We had about 50 workers, but not all of us lost our jobs. In fact, I think the worst part of the story is actually not those who lost their jobs, but those who kept them. So I'm really not here to talk about myself as much as I am the people who kept their jobs. When we were there, we had a few people from India working as contractors. And they lived in the complex that I was renting an apartment, and I got to know them quite well. I firmly believe that when you are dealing with difficult situations, you should be with other people and talk with them about it. Being silent and keeping to yourself leads to isolation, and we don't need that. We want to shine the light of day on problems. So I got to get to know them quite well, and they were all kind of in one apartment, about five of them staying in one place, and I kind of was wondering what they were doing, and they told me that they were quite upset about the office closing as well. But what they were upset about was a little bit different. They were being paid $7 an hour where they were working with us, and they were told that if they could keep their jobs, but they were going to have to move to China and take a pay cut to $3 an hour. So as you can see, it really doesn't matter where you are in this world. These deals are isolating us, and they are not allowing us to be together on issues that are affecting all of us. So I'm very heartened here to see everybody, you know, that showed up today, that they're going to be going in and telling Senator Wyden that we need to shine the light of day on this deal. And we need to tell him that fast track needs to end. That is an old policy that we do not need anymore. These deals that are being negotiated, supposedly in our names, are not being done in the light of day. And we need to tell him we need to know what's going on, and that he needs to negotiate for us and represent us.
Again, a demonstration of a few dozen activists against the free trade agreement, Trans-Pacific Partnership. Many of these demonstrators have on hard hats and belong to local unions, and they're about to take thousands of floppy disks that have signatures on them against the Trans-Pacific Partnership, with the message Trans-Pacific Partnership and Fast Track is a flop. Jamie Partridge, Cable News.
A long-awaited review of the Cover Oregon State Health Insurance Exchange was released today and was followed immediately by the resignation of Cover Oregon Director Bruce Goldberg. Governor John Kitzhaber announced in a morning press conference that he was angry and disappointed over the insurance exchange disaster. The government said he is taking a number of steps to help Cover Oregon deliver on a, quote, promise to Oregonians that I've been pursuing now for 25 years, access to quality and affordable health care. A main finding in the report was that there was no single point of authority between the three agencies, Oregon Health Authority, the Department of Human Services, and Cover Oregon. The state of Oregon commissioned the independent report, which follows a similar damaging report 2 weeks ago by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. The state report found that communication across agencies was ineffective and at times contentious and often involved competing priorities. The lack of a single point of authority slowed the decision-making process, and it created a situation where the agencies involved often had no idea what the other agencies were doing. The report also questioned why Oracle was selected as the vendor to create the entire Cover Oregon website.
The Sierra Club held a press conference in the Pearl District this morning, all urging elected leaders to take a stand against coal exports in Oregon. Dennis Todaro, a financial advisor from Spokane, was among those who spoke at a press conference.
China's toxic air pollution resembles nuclear winter, says scientists. It slows photosynthesis in plants, potentially wreaking havoc on the country's food supply. This is accompanied by a photograph of Chinese people in their cities wearing masks in the midst of pollution, a cloud of pollution. They say that has a significant economic toll, grounding flights, closing highways, and keeping tourists at home. It says, well, that's in China. Why should I care about that? Well, the Chinese are getting the message. The only reason they're using coal is because it's what they have. But the Chinese government is working on a uranium-free nuclear plant powered by thorium. They have slid up the completion and implementation of this 15 years to a 10-year goal, an attempt to reduce its reliance on coal and cut air pollution. What is the useful life of this facility if it is created? I submit that the useful life ends the day it ceases to be profitable. We're looking at companies that are already not profitable. And I don't know if it's hope or if the thought that increasing production and inventory will make prices go up motivate them to want to do this, but from a business standpoint, I can't recommend it. Personally, I come from back east, and I grew up before the environmental movement got a whole lot of traction, and I can remember the Hudson River and the East River and the Delaware River and the Hackensack River and the Passaic River and many other bodies of water that were polluted, and they had to work very hard to clean them up, and in many instances, the job is not done. Right now, I live in Spokane, and we look around and we see the remains of abandoned mining facilities. And those have, in some instances, turned into quaint ghost towns, and in some instances, not so quaint. And we are cautioned not to eat the fish that we count in many of the waterways because of the remaining mine tailings. And I submit that the potential exists for that to happen here, that this facility could be built if the permit is granted, and it will be up to the citizens and the taxpayers, I think, to mitigate the site and deal with it if it is not successful. And why should the next 5 years be different than the last 5 years? I do not see an incumbent reason for that. So from an investment standpoint, it does not, to me anyway, as a professional in the industry, show much promise. So environmentalists say, from the environmental argument, that this carbon has to stay in the ground, that it can't be burnt, it should not be burnt for the environment, for the climate. Financial professionals say, why would you want to? When does this start making economic sense? Just from that perspective. Like the other speakers, I recommend that the governor at least study this carefully before granting it. And my suggestion would be to not grant it at all.
That was Dennis Todaro, a Washington State financial advisor, speaking at the press conference. KBOE reporter Robin Ryan was at the press conference and questioned the panel when the event concluded.
What mechanisms remain to the people to continue a dialogue in the direction of the governor to put the brakes on this project?
We need to get access to the governor's office. We need to be in the governor's office. We need to speak to his advisors, particularly his economic advisors. And we need to raise these points about the total economic costs of this project, about the total environmental risks, which have clear economic implications attached to them in terms of the loss of our natural assets, our cultural assets, and damage to our industries, including recreation and fishing. I would say let's start there. Let's start by making those points.
I'm not hearing a lot in the debate with regard to alternative energy sources like wind and or solar. Can you tell me why that might be?
I think we should be talking about coal in comparing it to renewable energy, if for no other reason that renewable energy creates, on average, over twice the number of jobs per $1 million invested that coal does. So I think we ought to be making that point, that if what we want to do in the state of Oregon is to create more jobs, we should be thinking about renewable energy and not about coal. Thanks.
What the single most important thing folks can do to have an impact on this discussion?
I would say that if people feel strongly about this, and they should, get active. Contact the Sierra Club if you want something to do. We can always use volunteers. California just got the new lithium-ion battery plant that's going to be built by Tesla and Apple. And the proposal here is for us to get a coal transfer facility. I was wondering who got first choice on that. If we're going to make this kind of investment with capital, with land use, with potential risks to water and other resources, that there are a lot better ways to deploy that capital to generate jobs, which we all want. But I think we can do that without harming the environment and perhaps furthering the mission of alternative energy to eventually leave what I view as a 19th century, not 20th century, a 19th century technology. Unless we're bringing back steam engines, I don't think we should be plowing new money into coal just as an investor.
That was KBOO's Robin Ryan at a press conference held by the Sierra Club in the Pearl District this morning, calling on elected officials to halt coal exports in Oregon.
And the third in a series of recent natural gas leaks on Sovey Island occurred on Monday, and it's not expected to be the last one. The leaks are occurring at the transfer station at 14430 Northwest Gillihan Road, which transfers gas from the Williams Company pipeline to the Northwest Natural Gas Pipeline. There have been three leaks in the past 2 months, the first occurring January 10th. It did cause a fire and an evacuation of the area. An emergency release valve has been opening and expelling natural gas into the air. Nearby residents have compared the sound of the leaks to a jet engine. The repeated leaks are thought to be caused by metal debris somewhere in the pipeline. A filter to prevent this debris is in the works, but it won't be available for 2 to 3 months. Pressure's been reduced through the pipeline to try to prevent future leaks, but this has been no guarantee. So far, authorities have had to evacuate homes, they've had to close the Sovey Island Academy, and even shut down the bridge and roads during the leaks. The lack of information available to local residents has rumors flying amid fears of business loss due to road closures. Some Sovey Island residents say they're afraid for their health and safety, and while officials from Williams Companies Incorporated say that residents should not be worried, many of them still feel that they've been left in the dark.
Union County Commissioners recently voted unanimously to close Shelter from the Storm, a facility that helps victims of domestic violence and survivors of sexual assault. Shelter from the Storm was allocated $10,000 from the state of Oregon to build a sexual assault forensic exam room at the facility. That money remains on hold until the nonprofit can secure a new home or find a way to keep their doors open. KBOO spoke with the executive director of Shelter from the Storm, Teresa Krauser.
This is Kristen Yount for KBOO News. Today I'm speaking with Teresa Krauser, who's the executive director for Shelter from the Storm. So what's going on with Shelter from the Storm?
Well, it's a little more than what is just going on with Shelter from the Storm. Union County has been the recipient of funding to build a new courthouse that we desperately need. And due to the limited availability of spaces to erect new buildings in La Grande, Union County is looking at demolishing the building that we're in and building the new courthouse here.
You found out that you were going to have to move back in January, and then there was sort of, from what I understand, a symbolic vote a couple weeks ago. What has happened since then?
Well, we were notified on January 15th of the intent to site the new courthouse on the Shelter from the Storm building's footprint. And then on March 5th, Our Board of County Commissioners officially voted in a public meeting to proceed with that plan. And we have, during this whole process, been attempting to express our concern to the county commissioners of the possibility of our services being interrupted if we have to move. That will unfortunately be the case. And just this morning, myself and two of our board co-chairs met with the county and their legal counsel, and we were informed that the county is not prepared to offer any financial assistance to help Shelter from the Storm relocate.
So they're going to tear down this building that was built especially for Shelter for the Storm to put in a new courthouse. Is that right?
That is correct. And the county was the recipient of the CBDG block grant. So it's kind of required that the grants be written that way. It either has to have a city or a county be the entity applying for the funds, and then they actually own the building because they were the applicant of the grant. But the grant was specific that this facility was being built for us and to serve victims of domestic and sexual abuse. And we've been here for a little over 16 years, I believe.
What is the next step? Is there any legal recourse? Since you are partnered with the county for grant monies, is there any way to show that they're sort of breaching their agreement by being a co-writer of a grant for a facilities grant, and then turning around and tearing it down 16 years later? I mean,
community block development grant only had a 5-year continued lease clause, so there isn't really any recourse as far as that goes. But I have spoken to HUD, and they have confirmed that what is customary in these types of situations is that generally the city or the county entity that receives the grant funding would then in turn deed the facility over to the nonprofit that it was intended to serve.
And they didn't do that, so now you're out of luck.
They did not do that, and this is a very serious time for our community. We are the only domestic violence and sexual assault services provider for all of Union County. So that would be LeGrand and I believe 5 other towns that border the city of LeGrand. Last year we served 642 unduplicated survivors, and the year prior to that it was 663.
So definitely serving, you know, that's a lot of people that are going to go without services in the next year if you are not able to operate, and that is very unfortunate.
That's correct. This situation, if we have to close our doors, will not only impact the safety of our community, but it will impact the economic structure in our community. We have an annual operating budget of $500,000. That trickles into our community, and that's at risk as well.
So is there anything people can do? Is there anybody we could write to or talk to try and advocate for Shelter from the Storm from closing?
Well, I think this is a twofold issue, because not only do we want to advocate for Shelter from the Storm not to close, we want to advocate for a new courthouse as well. So I think just asking the commissioners if they would revisit the site and possibly find another location would be helpful. Also, the Oregon Judicial Department in Salem has a contract with Union County for a deadline within which the funds for the courthouse have to be utilized. So if the Oregon Judicial Department would be willing to relax the deadline, provide an extension, or amend the agreement, that might be helpful as well. The community has expressed support, and I feel that we're all really conflicted about this, because it seems to be that we're sacrificing one very vital service for something else that is also needed. And it's our hope that we can find a way that we can keep both.
This is, again, Teresa Krausen, and she is the executive director of Shelter from the Storm, which serves victims of domestic violence and sexual abuse survivors. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Kristen.
Oregon continues to lead the nation as a state for corporate income tax avoidance. A review by the Oregon Center for Public Policy reveals that at least 24 Oregon corporations that made a profit in the year 2011 paid no Oregon state income taxes that year. Eight of those corporations reported profits exceeding $5 million. Also, a national report released today, authorized by the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy and also the Citizens for Tax Justice, states that 90 profitable Fortune 500 companies paid zero state income taxes in at least one recent year. This includes Oregon-based Intel, Nike, and Precision Cast Parts. The ability of corporations to pay less than the minimum tax stems from an Oregon Supreme Court decision last year known as the Conway Loophole. That decision, allowing the Conway Trucking Company to use tax credits to pay their entire tax liability, paved the way for other corporations to take advantage of accounting measures to reduce their tax liabilities. Chuck Sheketoff of the Oregon Center for Public Policy described a shortcoming in Oregon law that keeps Oregonians in the dark about the amount a corporation has paid in state income taxes. Sheketoff said Oregonians have a right to know which large profitable corporations are using accounting gimmicks, special laws, and loopholes to avoid paying state income taxes on their profits. Federal securities law, however, requires corporations to disclose their state tax liabilities. The national report reveals that a number of corporations with large operations in Oregon paid no income taxes in the years 2011 and 2012, including Facebook, which operates a large data center in Prineville, Oregon, and Facebook reported a $2.9 billion profit over that two-year period, paying no state income taxes in Oregon.
Medical marijuana patients in Oregon will soon be saying goodbye to magic brownies. On Wednesday, Governor John Kitzhaber signed into law Senate Bill 1531, aimed at regulating and setting a moratorium on medical marijuana dispensaries. The most noteworthy regulations are rules aimed at preventing minors from consuming medical marijuana products. The Oregon Health Authority drafted rules for the law within a day that should begin taking effect within a week. The rules prohibit sweet foods like cakes, cookies, candy, and gum, or other products that are sweet or colorful that could attract children. The bill also limits the packaging of the products. No package or logo can feature cartoon images, and packaging must be childproof and opaque. Opponents of the bill claim that many medical marijuana patients prefer eating a cookie to smoking medical marijuana. They also point out that these restrictions are not applied to other medicines that may be appealing to children. Colorado has taken similar steps, making it mandatory that recreational and medical marijuana be sold in childproof, opaque packaging, and giving shops the authority to confiscate suspected false IDs in the same manner as a liquor store.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with a member of the Portland Harbor Superfund Committee about a planned crude oil terminal along the Willamette River. This will be followed by Wisdom of the Elders at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather will be mostly clear with a low of about 34 degrees in the morning, so be on the lookout for icy spots. However, tomorrow will be warmer than today with a high of perhaps 57 degrees. The folks at radcast.org have temporarily suspended the daily radiation count until they are able to get more volunteers to support the effort. You can find more information on how to help at radcast.org.
It's 5:30, time for a daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Mothers everywhere warn children not to put any food in their mouths unless they know where it came from. The same should apply to putting information in our heads. For instance, the Employment Policy Institute has recently run full-page newspaper ads alerting the public and policymakers that an impressive group of some 650 economists who are supporting an increase in America's minimum wage includes many who are radical researchers. The Institute's message is that no one should listen to, much less respect, this group of economists. But wait, many in the group are radical? How many? The ads only list 8 and offers only innuendo as, quote, proof of their radicalism. And by the way, what and who is the Employment Policy Institute? Sounds legit, but is it? Not at all. It's a nonprofit front group run by longtime corporate operative Richard Berman. It gets millions of dollars in tax-exempt donations from fast food chains and other corporate interests trying to kill the wage increase, then funnels that money into Berman's for-profit PR firm, which also represents the restaurant industry. To make its case, the Institute has cited several, quote, academic reports that assail the wage increase on multiple fronts. But just as Berman refuses to disclose the names of the corporate giants funding him, he also never mentions that more than half of the economists whose papers he cites are paid by him. One, Joseph Sabia, has been given $250,000 in 8 grants from Berman's Institute. In addition, an independent analysis of one of Sabia's reports found that the data was skewed to make it seem that a New York wage hike had a negative impact on employment, which simply was not true. This is Jim Hightower saying, this phony institute is a scam and a scandal. So, Mama says, don't put any of its stuff in your head.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
A military judge acquitted a former Naval Academy midshipman today of sexual assault at the end of a 3-day trial. Colonel Daniel Doherty, the trial judge, referred a lesser charge against the defendant of making false statements back to the Naval Academy for a decision. The defendant, Joshua Tate, was one of 3 former Navy football players charged with sexual assault at a 2012 yoga and toga party where men wore togas and women wore yoga pants. Midshipman Tate became the lone defendant in the case after charges were dropped against the other 2. One original defendant's pretrial statements were declared inadmissible in court because he hadn't been read his rights. The 3rd original defendant had his case dropped in October when the head of the Naval Academy declared there were no reasonable grounds to believe that he had committed any crime. The young woman making the complaint arrived at the party intoxicated and in a grueling 5-hour testimony said that she had no memory of being sexually assaulted until her friends told her later that she had engaged in intercourse with several men. Defense attorneys claimed that the woman was a willing participant. An attorney for the woman said that the victim was beyond disappointed at the level of impunity revealed by the charge's dismissal. This case and others have called into question the method of trying sexual assault cases in the military justice system.
The United States boycotted a 3rd round of talks on drone strikes and related human rights violations held at the United Nations Human Rights Council on Wednesday. Pakistan is pushing a draft resolution in those talks aimed at the United States drone attacks. The Pakistani draft asks nations to ensure transparency and record keeping about drone strikes and to, quote, conduct prompt, independent, and impartial investigations, unquote, whenever there are indications of human rights violations caused by drone strikes. In 2009, President Obama engaged the United States and the Human Rights Council after years of a U.S. boycott by former President George W. Bush. However, the U.S.'s no-show at the talks is in line with the Obama administration's refusal to share public information about U.S. drone wars and those killed in the attacks. The Bureau of Investigative Journalism documents alarming rates of civilian deaths by covert U.S. attacks in Yemen, Pakistan, and Somalia. Also, a 21-page report released earlier this month by a United Nations human rights official also identifies drone strikes in which civilians were killed, injured, or threatened by the U.S. and its close ally, Israel. These strikes occurred in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, and the Gaza Strip. The U.S. boycott of the talks comes as the superpower escalates its covert drone war in Yemen, with at least 7 suspected strikes just in the first 2 weeks of March.
Next, we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The 14,000 International Association of Machinists Workers at American Airlines could be headed for the strike lines after a 30-day cooling-off period unless a labor contract agreement is reached. And if they strike, the 22,000 members of the Transport Workers Union at American say they will support the strike. IAM is tired of its U.S. Airways members making 10% less money than their counterparts at American Airlines. The IAM wants its members to be on the same wage level as TWU workers doing the same work. Now that the airlines are merged into the new American Airlines, the union wants to reach an agreement to increase their members' pay. IAM had been trying for 2 years to reach a deal with U.S. Airways. The union has asked the National Mediation Board for a release from negotiation that would trigger a 30-day cooling-off period. If no agreement is reached after that, IAM's 14,000 members could go on strike at the merged American Airlines. The bakery union, BCTGM, has launched a new website called KelloggGreed.com. 220 BCTGM workers continue to be locked out of Kellogg's Memphis, Tennessee cereal plant as the highly profitable company demands concessions aimed at creating a largely part-time casual workforce. BCTGM says Kellogg's plan is to replace steady middle-class full-time jobs in the U.S. with part-time workers with significantly lower wages and substandard benefits. Speaking in a video produced by the BCTGM union, Walter Johnson III describes some of what Kellogg's lockout has done to him.
I was diagnosed with atrial fibrillation. They took me out in the ambulance. The day we got locked out of our job, I lost my company insurance, all medical benefits. That day, I couldn't get the heart operation I needed, which meant I could have had a stroke. I mean, it was scary sitting there wondering, am I gonna make it till I can finally have this surgery? For years, I did right by my company, but they did not do right by me.
The New York, New Jersey Area Port Authority Board of Commissioners has voted unanimously to develop a living wage policy. The policy will also improve benefits. In January, Port Authority Executive Director Patrick Foye told airlines flying in and out of the region's airports to immediately bump wages up $1 an hour and to phase in at least $10.10 an hour for all workers. Workers at LaGuardia and JFK got the increase, but Newark Airport workers didn't. The Port Authority wants to raise standards higher than that going forward. Most of the airport workers fighting for higher wages are represented by SEIU 32BJ. Unite Here represents concessions workers at the airports.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Secretary of State John Kerry announced that Uganda's president has agreed to meet with U.S. experts on homosexuality and LGBT issues. In Uganda, the recently passed Anti-Homosexuality Act targets same-sex activity. Offenders face sentences up to life in prison, as do any who fail to report them. President Yoweri Museveni and lawmakers have claimed social factors are the sole basis of homosexuality. In related news, the organization Sexual Minorities Uganda, or SMUG, has filed a lawsuit in U.S. federal court against an American evangelical minister. Scott Lively is known in Oregon for helping enact the state's constitutional same-sex marriage ban. Lively faces charges of international crimes against humanity under the Alien Tort Claims Act. The filing alleges that Lively encouraged government-backed acts of violence against gay people in Uganda. Some governments and organizations have withdrawn aid to Uganda since the Anti-Homosexuality Act was signed. However, the U.S. has provided $485 million in aid to Uganda so far in 2014. Also, according to Kerry, the U.S. State Department is taking a unique approach to each of several East African countries that have enacted anti-LGBT legislation.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, March 20th, 2014.
Israeli troops invade West Bank communities and clash with local youth, and the Army Civil Administration hand out demolition orders to Palestinian-owned structures. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A number of Palestinians were injured and 17 kidnapped during invasions targeting West Bank communities on Thursday. Security sources said that Israeli forces raided Jenin City in northern West Bank and its refugee camp three times, with clashes erupting between soldiers and young Palestinians. Most wounded residents suffered the effects of tear gas inhalation and received treatment by local medics. Several Palestinians were also injured after being attacked and beaten by the invading soldiers. Occupation forces abducted on Thursday 12 Palestinians from the village of Zabuba, west of Jenin. Moreover, 5 Palestinians were kidnapped on Thursday by Israeli troops from Azzoun village east of Qalqilya. Israeli forces also stormed the village of Beit Qad, Deir Abu Da'if, Malaysia, and Az-Zababda in northern West Bank, set several military checkpoints at the main entrances, and hindered the movement of the citizens. Later on Thursday afternoon, many civilians were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation when Israeli soldiers invaded the village of Al-Tabaka in southern West Bank. Troops invaded the village and fired tear gas into residents' homes, causing damage and injuries, witnesses reported. Elsewhere, Israeli occupation authorities on Thursday morning served 4 demolition orders for infrastructure projects in the Palestinian village of Khirbet Al-Tawil to the south of the West Bank city of Nablus. The Israeli Army's civil administration personnel, accompanied with military patrols, came to Khirbet Al-Tawil in the morning, handed residents demolition orders for power lines and water reservoir. The orders include the demolition of the power network, which was funded by the Belgian government in 2007. Also included is the demolition of a water network and pipes linking houses, agricultural facilities and fields, as well as the demolition of a well which gathers water owned by Palestinian farmers and a power pole.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, the Afghan Taliban is conducting a violent campaign to disrupt the upcoming national elections, including at least 2 brutal attacks today. 4 teenage gunmen launched an attack on the Serena Hotel in the capital city of Kabul, killing 9 people with point-blank gunshots to the head, including 2 children. The attackers smuggled pistols into the guarded hotel in their socks, authorities say. All 4 gunmen were killed by security forces. Also, a suicide bombing killed 18 in the eastern city of Jalalabad. The bombing took place at a police station, which has been the site of repeated attacks during the war. The Taliban has claimed responsibility for both incidents.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Daniel Field, Theo Burke, Robin Ryan, Claire Valentine Fossum, and Kristen Yount. The producer is Sam Bowman. Our engineer is Matthew Olson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Yanka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Jen Chavez. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Ani and Lynn host Positively Revolting Talk Radio, a variety of topics from an eco-feminist and anarcho-feminist perspective. At 9, on Veterans Voice, Bill and Marvin interview Penny Lewis, the author of Hard Hats, Hippies, and Hawks, the Vietnam Anti-War Movement as Myth and Memory. She talks about how memory of that time has changed and how history is being rewritten by some historians. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentaries with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on the Radio Zine, host Michelle Schroeder Fletcher interviews John List, co-author of The Y-Axis, Hidden Motives, and the Undiscovered Economics of Everyday Life. And at 11:30, Ren Green speaks with KABU's volunteer coordinator, Ani Haynes, about KABU and community radio in general. Thanks to you KABU members for your generous support, by the way. If you are not a member, don't worry, you can become one by becoming to KB by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And stay tuned now for an interview with a member of the Portland Harbor Superfund Committee about a planned crude oil terminal along the Willamette River. Good night, Robert.
Good night, Jen.
Good night,
Matthew.
Good night.
I'm speaking now with Barbara Quinn. Barbara is a member of the Portland Harbor Superfund Community Advisory Group. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your group's testimony to the DEQ recently on the crude oil terminal that was recently announced.
We met as in a general meeting and had a DEQ representative present on March 12th. And we brought in some information that we'd learned from the media about this site. The site happens to be within the purview of the DEQ because it's considered an upland pollution source site, or it has been in the last number of years since we've been doing Superfund. So when we talked to the DEQ representative and showed the information, his response was that he knew nothing about the new company that's coming in that is going to be dealing with crude oil, shipment, storage, possible refining. He knew nothing about it. And he said he learned from the media, just as we had, that that's the nature of the company. He's been dealing with this site for a long time, and the site has problems and issues. Right now it has $10,000 in penalties for not monitoring their stormwater runoff. And they also had a giant chemical spill, 11,000 gallons of naphtha, in 2011. So the site is up in the air as far as how much pollution is on the site, how much is getting to the river.
And can you tell our listeners just where this site is that we're talking about for this crude oil terminal?
Yes, the site is located at 5501 Northwest Front Avenue, and it's directly across the Willamette River, the west side of the Willamette River, from the University of Portland. Definitely within the purview of the Superfund, which is the lower 11 miles of the Willamette River. And it's in the heart of our community with residential housing all around it.
And how is it that this got through the permitting process without the approval of the Department of Environmental Quality? I thought that one of the requirements for permits would have been from the DEQ.
We would have thought the same thing. In fact, we feel that maybe we're not getting all the information. They stressed at the meeting that they didn't feel that this new business was doing something different than the old business. And so only if the new business decided to start refining would there be a permitting process, and then there would be commentary. But we were questioning that as well, because it seemed like a change of business to us. But
Well, the current site is not an oil terminal. As far as I know, it's a former asphalt plant, right?
Correct, yes. They had petroleum products on site, but as far as we knew, no, there was no crude oil there. This is the crude oil that's from the Bakken field up in North Dakota, which is the volatile kind of crude oil that explodes. And it has a high content of propane and gasoline.
And do you have any familiarity with the company, ARC Logistics, that is putting forward this terminal here in Portland?
Yes. We have a little bit of information about them through other media. And what we've learned is that they say on their website that they deal in crude oils, light and heavy crude oils, and they transport, throughputting, transporting, receiving, and they also have a couple of locations that do refining. So that's a concern, because there is a refinery on that site. It's a smaller refinery, but there is one there.
But they haven't put in any application for refining at this point.
No, not that we were told.
And this company also just became a public company in November. So do they have a track record? Do you know anything about their safety record?
Well, what we know about their track record from just from recent media isn't good. They've had some troubles. And they've been in trouble with the EPA for smaller and larger infractions. So their reputation's not great. The company that is the former company on that site doesn't have a great track record either. So us as a citizens advisory, us not getting any answers about what's going on here is a little concerning. We think this is very closely connected with what we're trying to do with the Superfund cleanup, and it's a huge community concern. We're not really getting enough answers is what I feel.
And you mentioned the Superfund. For people who aren't familiar with the Portland Harbor Superfund, what is mm-hmm. it, and what are some of the issues there in general?
Well, there's a lot of issues with our Willamette River Superfund. The lower 11 miles is now being studied. We're coming up with a feasibility study, and when I say we, I mean the companies that line the harbor are basically responsible for doing the feasibility study that comes up with methods of cleanup. And usually, you know, so we're in the 14th year of the 15-year process for this cleanup, and so we're getting pretty close to a record of decision, and the EPA and the DEQ are involved. EPA deals with the contaminated sediments in the river, and the DEQ is trying to stem the upland, the sites that are upland from the river from contaminated runoff from their site or their groundwater. So both of those agencies are involved. We're a citizens committee or advisory group that is representing neighborhoods in North and Northwest Portland. So we're getting close to the end of this process. We're within maybe a year or two.
What's the cleanup plan that's being implemented?
Well, there's several plans that are being suggested. I think there's something like a choice of, I think they're going to submit something like in the neighborhood of 20 plans that are different at different levels of cleanup. And it's up to the EPA to choose one of those. And they each plan contains different methods, which might be a combination of dredging, capping, and maybe some bioremediation. Yeah, one of the suggestions that we're fighting tooth and nail is the idea of doing a toxic waste dump out here.
There would also be an expansion of a toxic waste dump that would leach into the Willamette River. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah, they have done a 60% engineering, and they say that the proposed toxic waste dump would have a sand berm across it. It would be in slip 1 at T4, and this suggestion has come from the Port of Portland. And the sand berm would leach toxins back into the river to some degree. They're claiming that they don't think it would trigger the Clean Water Act, but it doesn't seem like a very good solution to us for any number of reasons. The same problem we have with the toxic waste dump, it being located on a volatile river system on top of sand in a flood zone, hazardous flood zone, and also when we're expecting an earthquake. It's the same reason you would not want to locate volatile crude oil in the same system, and that is what's being suggested here, is that they want 84 tanks of explosive crude oil on basically sand, and that's not a very good or stable situation.
And I guess the justification that's been given is that there is toxic waste there already, and it would be more dangerous to ship it out of the Portland Harbor area. Have you heard that argument?
I've heard that argument, but they basically backed off of that. They said that they could manage it so that it could be shipped safely to a lined dump. There is pollution on that site, But what they're suggesting to do is to gather up all the polluted sediments within the 11 miles. And, of course, you know, the ones that are we're most concerned about, the ones that most affect human health, are things like PCBs, PAHs. And it's not clear how many of those would go into this toxic waste dump, but any of those in the toxic waste dump wouldn't be good because they're carcinogens. And they would concentrate them here in our community. And we are thinking that is not a cleanup. That further exposes us to risk. It's not acceptable. And we want to see a better solution that actually involves cleaning up.
So your hope would be that they would ship the toxic waste out of the Portland Harbor to a lined dump somewhere else in the state, and then at some point the Willamette River would be cleaned up to the point where people could actually swim in it again?
That's what we hope. That's what we want here for this. Northwest Portland would like to have a river that's clean enough to eat fish out of and that we don't feel unsafe swimming in and that we're not afraid of the shoreline mud, which right now we're told contains bad chemicals. We feel that this is an equity issue out here. We should have a river that people can enjoy. It's a community asset. It's part of the commons. And it should not be unsafe for our community.
You mentioned that it's an equity issue. Do you feel that the reason that this hasn't been addressed is because the communities that are in contact with the Portland Harbor are not wealthy communities?
I definitely believe that that plays a huge role in this whole siting of this toxic waste dump. Yes.
And what about this crude oil terminal? What's the status of it? Is it a sure thing, or are there still other hurdles that this company has to overcome in order to put this crude oil terminal in place in Northwest Portland?
It doesn't sound like, from what we learned at our meeting, that there are. It's not clear whether there's any other hurdles. Apparently, they have to do a spill contingency plan, and there will be a comment period, but it wasn't clear. We were not told when that would happen, and it did not sound to us like there were too many other hurdles for this company, and that's very disturbing.
And since this wasn't one of the coal and oil export terminals that have been put forward by activists as a target for the campaigns, do you feel that it's kind of being neglected?
Well, it's kind of a surprise. It just happened in January. It's a surprise, and I think that people don't know about it yet. They don't know that there's being proposed an oil terminal slash possible refinery right in the middle of Portland, or pretty close to it, right in the heart of a residential area, which is going to involve barging, trucking, and moving by rail crude oil from Bakken.
And are people organizing in opposition to this terminal, and are there steps that people can take at this point?
Well, there's some very good information on the Columbia Riverkeeper site, and I know that the Willamette Riverkeeper has spoken out against it very quickly, but there's not a huge amount of information. Two articles that I've written for the local paper, the St. John's Review, there's not a lot of information out about it yet because it's new, and I think people don't realize what's happening yet.
So if people want to find out more information, probably the best way is to keep checking the Columbia Riverkeeper website, which is columbiariverkeeper.org, and I'm sure they will update it with any upcoming public comment period or the status of this crude oil terminal.
There is one other thing they can do. We are having another Superfund advisory meeting in April. We have them monthly. Our next one's on April 9th. And we're having the Willamette Riverkeeper come to that meeting and discuss this subject.
And where is that meeting on April 9th?
The meeting is held at the BES Water Lab at 6543 North Burlington. The meeting starts at 6.
So 6543 North Burlington, and that
is... Yes, it's right next to Cathedral Park.
Wednesday, April 9th at 6 o'clock is that
yeah.
meeting. And again, if you want to keep checking, ColumbiaRiverKeeper.org, that's another good place for information. I've been speaking with Barbara Quinn. She is a member of the Portland Harbor Superfund Community Advisory Group, and we've been talking about the recently exposed crude oil terminal that has been planned in Portland without really anybody knowing about it, that was recently made public. And the company involved is ARC Logistics, and the terminal will be in Northwest Portland if the company is able to move forward with it, which it looks like they have all of the permits to go ahead and begin construction, right?
That's what it sounds like.
Well, thanks for joining us today, Barbara Quinn. We will continue to follow this issue on the KBOO News as it develops. This is Jenka Soderberg for KBOO News.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland.
Welcome to Wisdom of the Elders. I'm Arlie Neskai of the Dene Nation. In this program, we celebrate the harvest. In Elder Wisdom, we'll meet several members of the Monacan Nation and learn how they gather from the abundance of wild foods in Virginia's Blue Mountains. Judy Bluehorse Skelton takes us on a summer gathering. Nico Wynn treats us to songs and dances celebrating food. Judy Trejo shares a handful of pine nut songs. And Jack Dalton tells a traditional Yupik story from Alaska called The Gathering Song.
The men kneeled on the ground, and the woman stood behind them.
Katoom, katoom,
the drum said. And all the people knew already which song was coming, the gathering song.
This is Wisdom of the Elders. Stay with us.
You're listening to Wade Fernandez doing his composition, A Guitar Chants for the People, from his album, Wachiwa na Pismawao. You can learn more about Wade and his music at wadefernandez.com.
Thank you.
This is Wisdom of the Elders. I'm Arlie Nesky. For some indigenous peoples of North America, the harvest of wild foods is still central to the way of life as it was for their ancestors of past centuries. The Monacans gather and enjoy wild foods along with the fruits and other crops from the orchards and farms in Virginia's Blue Mountains. In this chapter,